This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Side 1, RC45198, The Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch by Philip K. Dick. Copyright 1964 by Philip K. Dick. Read by Gary Tells. This book contains 230 pages on 6 sides. If you would like to skip over any remaining announcements or introductory material, place your cassette player and fast forward until a beep is heard. Stop at that point to hear the beginning of the book. Library of Congress Annotation. Earth is too hot to be comfortable, and the colonies on other planets are not well developed, but drugs make it all bearable. Can-D is the preferred drug, although Chew-Z, produced by Palmer Eldritch, is a strong contender. Eldritch wants to control more than the drug market, as the people at the Can-D manufacturer find out the hard way. Some Strong Language, 1964. From the book jacket. Not too long from now, when exiles from a blistering Earth huddle miserably in Martian colonies, the only things that make life bearable are the drugs. Can-D translates those who take it into the bodies of Barbie-like dolls. Now there's competition, a substance called Chew-Z, marketed under the slogan, God promises eternal life, we can deliver it. The question is, what kind of eternity, and who or what is the deliverer? In this wildly disorienting funhouse of a novel, populated by godlike or perhaps satanic takeover artists and corporate psychics, Philip K. Dick explores mysteries that were once the property of St. Paul and Aquinas. His wit, compassion, and knife-edged irony make The Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch moving as well as genuinely visionary. About the author. Philip K. Dick was born in Chicago in 1928 and lived most of his life in California. He briefly attended the University of California but dropped out before completing any classes. In 1952, he began writing professionally and proceeded to write 36 novels and 5 short story collections. He won the Hugo Award for Best Novel in 1962 for The Man in the High Castle, and the John W. Campbell Memorial Award for Best Novel of the Year in 1974 for Flow My Tears, The Policeman Said. Philip K. Dick died of heart failure following a stroke on March 2, 1982, in Santa Ana, California. Other books by Philip K. Dick. The Divine Invasion, A Scanner Darkly, The Transmigration of Timothy Archer, Ubik, Valis. I mean, after all, you have to consider we're only made out of dust. That's admittedly not much to go on, and we shouldn't forget that. But even considering, I mean, it's a sort of bad beginning, we're not doing too bad. So I personally have faith that even in this lousy situation we're faced with, we can make it. You get me? From an inter-office audio memo circulated to pre-fash level consultants at Perky Pat Layouts Incorporated, dictated by Leo Bolero immediately on his return from Mars. 1. His head unnaturally aching, Barney Meyerson woke to find himself in an unfamiliar bedroom in an unfamiliar Conapt building. Beside him, the covers up to her bare, smooth shoulders, an unfamiliar girl slept on, breathing lightly through her mouth, her hair a tumble of cotton-like white. "I'll bet I'm late for work," he said to himself, slid from the bed and tottered to a standing position with eyes shut, keeping himself from being sick. For all he knew, he was several hours' drive from his office. Perhaps he was not even in the United States. However, he was on Earth. The gravity that made him sway was familiar and normal. And there, in the next room, by the sofa, a familiar suitcase, that of his psychiatrist, Dr. Smile. Barefoot, he padded into the living room and seated himself by the suitcase. He opened it, clicked switches and turned on Dr. Smile. Meters began to register and the mechanism hummed. "Where am I?" Barney asked it. "And how far am I from New York?" That was the main point. He saw now a clock on the wall of the apt's kitchen. The time was 7:30 a.m., not late at all. The mechanism, which was the portable extension of Dr. Smile, connected by micro-relay to the computer itself in the basement level of Barney's own Connaught building in New York, the renowned 33, tinnily declared, "Ah, Mr. Meyerson." "Meyerson," Barney corrected, smoothing his hair with fingers that shook. "What do you remember about last night?" Now he saw, with intense physical aversion, half-empty bottles of bourbon and sparkling water, lemons, bitters, and ice cube trays on the sideboard in the kitchen. "Who is this girl?" Dr. Smile said, "This girl in the bed is Miss Rondinella Fugate. Ronnie, as she asked you to call her." It sounded vaguely familiar, and oddly in some manner tied up with his job. "Listen," he said to the suitcase. But then in the bedroom the girl began to stir. At once he shut off Dr. Smile and stood up, feeling humble and awkward in only his underpants. "Are you up?" the girl asked sleepily. She thrashed about and sat facing him. Quite pretty, he decided, with lovely large eyes. "What time is it, and did you put on the coffee pot?" He tramped into the kitchen and punched the stove into life. It began to heat water for coffee. Meanwhile, he heard the shutting of a door. She had gone into the bathroom. Water ran. Ronnie was taking a shower. Again in the living room, he switched Dr. Smile back on. "What's she got to do with PP layouts?" he asked. "Miss Fugate is your new assistant. She arrived yesterday from People's China, where she worked for PP Layouts as their pre-fash consultant for that region. However, Miss Fugate, although talented, is highly inexperienced, and Mr. Bolero decided that a short period as your assistant, I would say under you, but that might be misconstrued, considering..." "Great," Barney said. He entered the bedroom, found his clothes, they had been deposited, no doubt by him, in a heap on the floor, and began with care to dress. He still felt terrible, and it remained an effort not to give up and be violently sick. "That's right," he said to Dr. Smile as he came back to the living room buttoning his shirt. "I remember the memo from Friday about Miss Fugate. She's erratic in her talent. Picked wrong on that U.S. Civil War picture window item. If you can imagine it, she thought it'd be a smash hit in People's China." He laughed. The bathroom door opened a crack. He caught a glimpse of Ronnie, pink and rubbery and clean, drying herself. "Did you call me, dear?" "No," he said. "I was talking to my doctor." "Everyone makes errors," Dr. Smile said, a trifle vacuously. Barney said, "How'd she and I happen to..." He gestured toward the bedroom. "After so short a time." "Chemistry," Dr. Smile said. "Come on." "Well, you're both precogs. You previewed that you'd eventually hit it off, become erotically involved. So you both decided after a few drinks that why should you wait? Life is short, art is..." The suitcase ceased speaking, because Ronnie Fugate had appeared from the bathroom naked to pad past it and Barney back once more into the bedroom. She had a narrow, erect body, a truly superb carriage, Barney noted, and small, up-jutting breasts with nipples no larger than matched pink peas. Or rather, matched pink pearls, he corrected himself. Ronnie Fugate said, "I meant to ask you last night, why are you consulting a psychiatrist? And my lord, you carry it around everywhere with you. Not once did you set it down. And you had it turned on right up until..." She raised an eyebrow and glanced at him searchingly. "At least I did turn it off then," Barney pointed out. "Do you think I'm pretty?" Rising on her toes, she all at once stretched, reached above her head, then, to his amazement, began to do a brisk series of exercises, hopping and leaping, her breasts bobbing. "I certainly do," he murmured, taken aback. "I'd weigh a ton," Ronnie Fugate panted, "if I didn't do these UN weapons wing exercises every morning. Go pour the coffee, will you, dear?" Barney said, "Are you really my new assistant at PP Layouts?" "Yes, of course. You mean you don't remember? But I guess you're like a lot of really top-notch precogs. You see the future so well that you have only a hazy recollection of the past. Exactly what do you recall about last night?" She paused in her exercises, gasping for breath. "Oh," he said vaguely, "I guess everything." "Listen, the only reason why you'd be carrying a psychiatrist around with you is that you must have gotten your draft notice, right?" After a pause, he nodded. That, he remembered. The familiar elongated blue-green envelope had arrived 1 week ago. Next Wednesday, he would be taking his mental at the UN Military Hospital in the Bronx. "Has it helped? Has he," she gestured at the suitcase, "made you sick enough?" Turning to the portable extension of Dr. Smile, Barney said, "Have you?" The suitcase answered, "Unfortunately, you're still quite viable, Mr. Meyerson. You can handle 10 Freuds of stress. Sorry, but we still have several days. We've just begun." Going into the bedroom, Ronnie Fugate picked up her underwear and began to step into it. "Just think," she said reflectively. "If you're drafted, Mr. Meyerson, and you're sent to the colonies, maybe I'll find myself with your job." She smiled, showing superb, even teeth. It was a gloomy possibility, and his precog ability did not assist him. The outcome hung nicely, at perfect balance on the scales of cause and effect to be. "You can't handle my job," he said. "You couldn't even handle it in People's China, and that's a relatively simple situation in terms of factoring out pre-elements." But someday she could. Without difficulty, he foresaw that. She was young and overflowing with innate talent. All she required to equal him, and he was the best in the trade, was a few years' experience. Now he became fully awake as awareness of his situation filtered back to him. He stood a good chance of being drafted, and even if he was not, Ronnie Fugate might well snatch his fine, desirable job from him, a job up to which he had worked by slow stages over a 13-year period. A peculiar solution to the grimness of the situation, this going to bed with her, he wondered how he had arrived at it. Bending over the suitcase, he said in a low voice to Dr. Smile, "I wish you'd tell me why the hell, with everything so dire, I decided to..." "I can answer that," Ronnie Fugate called from the bedroom. She had now put on a somewhat tight, pale green sweater and was buttoning it before the mirror of her vanity table. "You informed me last night, after your 5th bourbon and water. You said..." She paused, eyes sparkling. "It's inelegant. What you said was this. If you can't lick 'em, join 'em. Only the verb you used, I regret to say, wasn't join." Barney said, and went into the kitchen to pour himself a cup of coffee. Anyhow, he was not far from New York. Obviously, if Miss Fugate was a fellow employee at PP Layouts, he was within commute distance of his job. They could ride in together, charming. He wondered if their employer, Leo Bolero, would approve of this if he knew. Was there an official company policy about employees sleeping together? There was about almost everything else, although how a man who spent all his time at the resort beaches of Antarctica or in German e-therapy clinics could find time to devise dogma on every topic eluded him. "Someday," he said to himself, "I'll live like Leo Bolero, instead of being stuck in New York City in 180-degree heat." Beneath him now, a throbbing began. The floor shook. The building's cooling system had come on. Day had begun. Outside the kitchen window, the hot, hostile sun took shape beyond the other Connaught buildings visible to him. He shut his eyes against it. Going to be another scorcher, all right, probably up to the 20 Wagner mark. He did not need to be a precog to foresee this. In the miserably high number, Connaught Building 492 on the outskirts of Marilyn Monroe, New Jersey, Richard Knatt ate breakfast indifferently, while, with something greater than indifference, he glanced over the morning homeopape's weather syndrome readings of the previous day. The Key Glacier, old Skin Top, had retreated 4.62 graybles during the last 24-hour period, and the temperature at noon in New York had exceeded the previous days by 1.46 Wagners. In addition, the humidity, as the oceans evaporated, had increased by 16 Selkirks. So things were hotter and wetter. The great procession of nature clanked on, and toward what? Knatt pushed the pape away and picked up the mail which had been delivered before dawn. It had been some time since mailmen had crept out in daylight hours. The first bill which caught his eye was the Apt Cooling Prorated Swindle. He owed Connaught 492 exactly 10.5 skins for the last month, a rise of 3/4 of a skin over April. Someday, he said to himself, it'll be so hot that nothing will keep this place from melting. He recalled the day his LP record collection had fused together in a lump. Back around 04, due to a momentary failure of the building's cooling network. Now he owned iron oxide tapes. They did not melt. And at the same moment, every parakeet and Venusian Ming bird in the building had dropped dead. And his neighbor's turtle had been boiled dry. Of course, this had been during the day, and everyone, at least the men, had been at work. The wives, however, had huddled at the lowest subsurface level, thinking, he remembered Emily telling him this, that the fatal moment had at last arrived. And not a century from now, but now. The Caltech predictions had been wrong, only of course they hadn't been. It had just been a broken power lead from the NY utility people. Robot workmen had quickly shown up and repaired it. In the living room, his wife sat in her blue smock, painstakingly painting an unfired ceramic piece with glaze. Her tongue protruded and her eyes glowed. The brush moved expertly, and he could see already that this was going to be a good one. The sight of Emily at work recalled to him the task that lay before him today, one which he did not relish. He said peevishly, "Maybe we ought to wait before we approach him." Without looking up, Emily said, "We'll never have a better display to present to him than we have now." "What if he says no?" "We'll go on. What did you expect, that we'd give up just because my one-time husband can't foresee or won't foresee how successful these new pieces will eventually be in terms of the market?" Richard Knatt said, "You know him, I don't. He's not vengeful, is he? He wouldn't carry a grudge." And anyhow, what sort of grudge could Emily's former husband be carrying? No one had done him any harm. If anything, it had gone the other way, or so he understood from what Emily had related. It was strange hearing about Barney Meyerson all the time and never having met him, never having direct contact with the man. Now that would end, because he had an appointment to see Meyerson at 9 this morning in the man's office at PP Layouts. Meyerson, of course, would hold the whip hand. He could take one brief glance at the display of ceramics and decline ad hoc. "No," he would say, "PP Layouts is not interested in a min of this. Believe my precog ability, my pre-fash marketing talent and skill." And out would go Richard Knatt, the collection of pots under his arm, with absolutely no other place to go. Looking out the window, he saw with aversion that already it had become too hot for human endurance. The footer runnels were abruptly empty as everyone ducked for cover. The time was 8:30, and he now had to leave. Rising, he went to the hall closet to get his pith helmet and his mandatory cooling unit. By law, one had to be strapped to every commuter's back until nightfall. "Goodbye," he said to his wife, pausing at the front door. Goodbye, and lots of luck. She had become even more involved in her elaborate glazing, and he realized all at once that this showed how vast her tension was. She could not afford to pause even a moment. He opened the door and stepped out into the hall, feeling the cool wind of the portable unit as it chugged from behind him. Oh, Emily said as he began to shut the door. Now she raised her head, brushing her long brown hair back from her eyes. Vid me as soon as you're out of Barney's office, as soon as you know one way or another. Okay, he said, and shut the door behind him. Down ramp at the building's bank, he unlocked their safety deposit box and carried it to a privacy room. There, he lifted out the display case containing the spread of ceramic ware which he was to show Meyerson. Shortly, he was aboard a thermo-sealed interbuilding commute car on his way to downtown New York City and PP Layouts, the great pale synthetic cement building from which Perky Pat and all the units of her miniature world originated. The doll, he reflected, which had conquered man, as man at the same time had conquered the planets of the Sol system. Perky Pat, the obsession of the colonists. What a commentary on colonial life. What more did one need to know about those unfortunates who, under the selective service laws of the UN, had been kicked off Earth, required to begin new, alien lives on Mars or Venus or Ganymede or wherever else the UN bureaucrats happened to imagine they could be deposited and, after a fashion, survive. And we think we've got it bad here, he said to himself. The individual in the seat next to him, a middle-aged man wearing the gray pith helmet, sleeveless shirt, and shorts of bright red, popular with the businessman class, remarked, "It's going to be another hot one." Yes. What you got there in that great big carton? A picnic lunch for a hovel of Martian colonists? Ceramics, Nat said. I'll bet you fire them just by sticking them outdoors at high noon. The businessman chuckled, then picked up his morning paper, opened it to the front page. Ship from outside the Sol system reported crash landed on Pluto, he said. Team being sent to find it. You suppose it's things? I can't stand those things from other star systems. It's more likely one of our own ships reporting back, Nat said. Ever seen a Proxima thing? Only pics. Grizzly, the businessman said. If they find that wrecked ship on Pluto and it is a thing, I hope they laser it out of existence. After all, we do have a law against them coming into our system. Right. Can I see your ceramics? I'm in neckties myself. The Werner simulated hand-wrought living tie in a variety of titanium colors. I have one on, see? The colors are actually a primitive life form that we import and then grow in cultures here on Terra. Just how we induce them to reproduce is our trade secret, you know, like the formula for Coca-Cola. Nat said, "For a similar reason, I can't show you these ceramics much as I'd like to. They're new. I'm taking them to a pre-fash precog at PP Layouts. If he wants to miniaturize them for the Perky Pat Layouts, then we're in. It's just a question of flashing the info to the PP disc jockey, what's his name, Circling Mars, and so on." Werner hand-wrought ties are part of the Perky Pat Layouts, the man informed him. Her boyfriend Walt has a closet full of them, he beamed. When PP Layouts decided to min our ties... It was Barney Meyerson you talked to? I didn't talk to him. It was our regional sales manager. They say Meyerson is difficult, goes on what seems like impulse, and once he's decided, it's irreversible. Is he ever wrong? Declines items that become fash? Sure. He may be a precog, but he's only human. I'll tell you one thing that might help. He's very suspicious of women. His marriage broke up a couple of years ago, and he never got over it. See, his wife became pregnant twice, and the board of directors of his CONAP building, I think it's 33, met and voted to expel him and his wife because they had violated the building code. Well, you know 33, you know how hard it is to get into any of the buildings in that low range. So instead of giving up his apt, he elected to divorce his wife and let her move, taking their child. And then later on, apparently, he decided he made a mistake and he got embittered. He blamed himself, naturally, for making a mistake like that. A natural mistake, though. For God's sake, what wouldn't you and I give to have an apt in 33 or 34? He never remarried. Maybe he's a neo-Christian. But anyhow, when you go to try to sell him on your ceramics, be very careful about how you deal with the feminine angle. Don't say, these will appeal to the ladies or anything like that. Most retail items are purchased. Thanks for the tip, Nat said, rising. Carrying his case of ceramics, he made his way down the aisle to the exit. He sighed. It was going to be tough, possibly even hopeless. He wasn't going to be able to lick the circumstances which long predated his relationship with Emily and her pots, and that was that. Fortunately, he managed to snare a cab. As it carried him through downtown cross-traffic, he read his own morning paper. In particular, the lead story about the ship believed to have returned from Proxima only to crash on Pluto's frozen wastes. An understatement. Already it was conjectured that this might be the well-known interplanet industrialist Palmer Eldritch, who had gone to the Prox system a decade ago at the invitation of the Prox Council of Humanoid Types. They had wanted him to modernize their autofacts along Terran lines. Nothing had been heard from Eldritch since. Now this. It would probably be better for Terra if this wasn't Eldritch coming back, he decided. Palmer Eldritch was too wild and dazzling a solo pro. He had accomplished miracles in getting autofact production started on the colony planets. But, as always, he had gone too far, schemed too much. Consumer goods had piled up in unlikely places where no colonists existed to make use of them. Mountains of debris they had become, as the weather corroded them bit by bit inexorably. Snowstorms, if one could believe that such still existed somewhere. There were places which were actually cold, too cold in actual fact. "Thy destination, Your Eminence," the autonomic cab informed him, halting before a large but mostly subsurface structure. PP layouts, with employees handily entering by its many thermal-protected ramps. He paid the cab, hopped from it, and scuttled across a short open space for a ramp, his case held with both hands. Briefly, naked sunlight touched him, and he felt, or imagined, himself sizzle. Baked like a toad. Dried of all life juices, he thought, as he safely reached the ramp. Presently, he was subsurface, being allowed into Meyerson's office by a receptionist. The rooms, cool and dim, invited him to relax, but he did not. He gripped his display case tighter, and tensed himself, and, although he was not a neo-Christian, he mumbled a prolix prayer. "Mr. Meyerson," the receptionist, taller than Nat and impressive in her open bodice dress and resort-style heels, said, speaking not to Nat, but to the man seated at the desk. "This is Mr. Nat," she informed Meyerson. "This is Mr. Meyerson, Mr. Nat." Behind Meyerson stood a girl in a pale green sweater and with absolutely white hair. The hair was too long and the sweater too tight. "This is Miss Fugate, Mr. Nat. Mr. Meyerson's assistant. Miss Fugate, this is Mr. Richard Nat." At the desk, Barney Meyerson continued to study a document without acknowledging the entrance of anyone, and Richard Nat waited in silence, experiencing a mixed bag of emotions. Anger touched him, lodged in his windpipe and chest, and of course, angst, and then, above even those, a tendril of growing curiosity. So this was Emily's former husband, who, if the living necktie salesman could be believed, still chewed mournfully, bitterly, on the regret of having abolished the marriage. Meyerson was a rather heavy-set man in his late 30s, with unusually, and not particularly fashionable, loose and wavy hair. He looked bored, but there was no sign of hostility about him. But perhaps he had not as yet. "Let's see your pots," Meyerson said suddenly. Laying the display case on the desk, Richard Knatt opened it, got out the ceramic articles one by one, arranged them, and then stepped back. After a pause, Bonnie Meyerson said, "No."
"No," Knatt said. "No what?"
Meyerson said, "They won't make it." He picked up his document and resumed reading it. "You mean you decided just like that?" Knatt said, unable to believe that it was already done. "Exactly like that," Meyerson agreed. He had no further interest in the display of ceramics. As far as he was concerned, Knatt had already packed up his pots and left. Miss Fugate said, "Excuse me, Mr. Meyerson." Glancing at her, Barney Meyerson said, "What is it?" "I'm sorry to say this, Mr. Meyerson," Miss Fugate said. She went over to the pots, picked one up, and held it in her hands, weighing it, rubbing its glazed surface. "But I get a distinctly different impression than you do. I feel these ceramic pieces will make it."
Knatt looked from one to the other of them. "Let me have that." Meyerson pointed to a dark gray vase. At once, Knatt handed it to him.
Meyerson held it for a time. "No," he said finally. He was frowning now. "I still get no impression of this item making it big. In my opinion, you're mistaken, Miss Fugate." He set the vase back down. "However," he said to Richard Knatt, "in view of the disagreement between myself and Miss Fugate," he scratched his nose thoughtfully, "leave this display with me for a few days. I'll give it further attention." Obviously, however, he would not. Reaching, Miss Fugate picked up a small, oddly shaped piece and cradled it against her bosom almost tenderly.
"This one in particular. I receive very powerful emanations from it. This one will be the most successful of all."
In a quiet voice, Barney Meyerson said, "You're out of your mind, Ronnie." He seemed really angry now. His face was violent and dark.
"I'll vid you," he said to Richard Knatt, "when I've made my final decision. I see no reason why I should change my mind, so don't be optimistic.
In fact, don't bother to leave them." He shot a hard, harsh glance toward his assistant, Miss Fugate. 2. In his office at 10 that morning, Leo Bolero, chairman of the board of directors of PP Layouts, received a vid call, which he had been expecting, from Tri-Planetary Law Enforcement, a private police agency. He had retained it within minutes of learning of the crash on Pluto by the intersystem ship returning from Prox. He listened idly because, despite the momentousness of the news, he had other matters on his mind. It was idiotic in view of the fact that PP Layouts paid an enormous yearly tribute to the UN for immunity, but idiotic or not, a UN Narcotics Control Bureau warship had seized an entire load of Can-D near the North Polar Cap of Mars, almost a million skins worth, on its way from the heavily guarded plantations on Venus. Obviously, the squeeze money was not reaching the right people within the complicated UN hierarchy. But there was nothing he could do about it. The UN was a windowless monad over which he had no influence. He could, without difficulty, perceive the intentions of the Narcotics Control Bureau. It wanted PP Layouts to initiate litigation aimed at regaining the shipload, because this would establish that the illegal drug Can-D, chewed by so many colonists, was grown, processed, and distributed by a hidden subsidiary of PP Layouts. So, valuable as the shipload was, better to let it go than to make a stab at claiming it. The homeopape conjectures were correct, Felix Blau, boss of the police agency, was saying on the vidscreen. "It is Palmer Eldritch, and he appears to be alive, although badly injured. We understand that a UN ship of the line is bringing him back to a base hospital. Location, of course, undisclosed." Leo Bolero said, nodding. "However, as to what Eldritch found in the Prox system..."
"You'll never find that out," Leo said. "Eldritch won't say, and it'll end there."
"One fact has been reported," Blau said. "Of interest.
Aboard his ship, Eldritch had, still has, a carefully maintained culture of a lichen very much resembling the Titanian lichen from which Can-D is derived. I thought in view of... Blau broke off tactfully. Is there any way those lichen cultures can be destroyed? It was an instinctive impulse. Unfortunately, Eldritch employees have already reached the remains of the ship. They undoubtedly would resist efforts in that direction. Blau looked sympathetic. We could, of course, try. Not a forceful solution, but perhaps we could buy our way in. Try, Leo said, although he agreed it was undoubtedly a waste of time and effort. Isn't there that law, that major UN ordinance against importing life forms from other systems? It would certainly be handy if the UN military could be induced to bomb the remains of Eldritch's ship. On his notepad, he scratched a memo to himself. Call lawyers, lodge complaint with UN over import of alien lichens. I'll talk to you later, he said to Blau and rang off. Maybe I'll complain directly, he decided. Pressing the tab on his intercom, he said to his secretary, Get me UN top in New York. Ask for Secretary Hepburn Gilbert personally. Presently, he found himself connected with the crafty Indian politician who last year had become UN secretary. Ah, Mr. Bolero, Hepburn Gilbert smiled shyly. You wish to complain as to the seizure of that shipment of Can-D, which... I know nothing about any shipment of Can-D, Leo said. This has to do with another matter completely. Do you people realize what Palmer Eldritch is up to? He's brought non-Sol lichens into our system. It could be the beginning of another plague like we had in 98. We realize this. However, the Eldritch people are claiming it to be a Sol lichen which Mr. Eldritch took with him on his prox trip and is now bringing back. It was a source of protein to him, they claim. The Indian's white teeth shone in gleeful superiority. The meager pretext amused him. You believe that? Of course not. Hepburn Gilbert's smile increased. What interests you in this matter, Mr. Bolero? You have an, special concern for lichens? I'm a public-spirited citizen of the Sol system, and I insist that you act. We are acting, Hepburn Gilbert said. We have made inquiries. We have assigned our Mr. Lark, you know him, to this detail, you see? The conversation droned to a frustrating conclusion, and Leo Bolero at last hung up, feeling irked at politicians. They managed to take forceful steps when it came to him, but in connection with Palmer Eldritch, Ah, Mr. Bolero, he mimicked to himself, that, sir, is something else again. Yes, he knew Lark. Ned Lark was chief of the UN Narcotics Bureau and the man responsible for the seizure of this last shipment of Can-D. It had been a ploy on the part of the UN secretary bringing Lark into this hassle with Eldritch. What the UN was angling for here was a quid pro quo. They would drag their feet, not act against Eldritch, unless and until Leo Bolero made some move to curtail his Can-D shipments. He sensed this, but could not, of course, prove it. After all, Hepburn Gilbert, that dark-skinned, sneaky little unevolved politician, hadn't exactly said that. That's what you find yourself involved in when you talk to the UN, Leo reflected. Afro-Asian politics. A swamp. It's run, staffed, directed by foreigners. He glared at the blank vid screen. While he was wondering what to do, his secretary, Miss Gleason, clicked on the intercom at her end and said, Mr. Bolero, Mr. Meyerson is in the outer office. He'd like a few moments with you.
Send him in.
He was glad for a respite. A moment later, his expert in the field of tomorrow's fashions came in scowling. Silently, Barney Meyerson seated himself facing Leo. What's eating you, Meyerson? Leo demanded. Speak up. That's what I'm here for, so you can cry on my shoulder. Tell me what it is and I'll hold your hand. He made his tone withering. My assistant, Miss Fugate. Yes, I hear you're sleeping with her. That's not the issue. Oh, I see, Leo said. That's just a minor aside. I just meant I'm here about another aspect of Miss Fugate's behavior. We had a basic disagreement a little while ago. A salesman, Leo said. You turned something down and she disagreed. Yes. You precogs. Remarkable. Maybe there were alternate futures. So you want me to order her in the future, always to back you up? Barney Meyerson said, she's my assistant. That means she's supposed to do as I direct. Well, isn't sleeping with you a pretty fair move in that direction? Leo laughed. However, she should back you up while salesmen are present. Then if she has any qualms, she should air them privately later on. I don't even go for that. Barney scowled even more. Acutely, Leo said, you know, because I take that E-therapy, I've got a huge frontal lobe. I'm practically a precog myself, I'm so advanced. Was it a pot, salesman? Ceramics? With massive reluctance, Barney nodded. They're your ex-wife's pots, Leo said. Her ceramics were selling well. He had seen ads in the homeopapes for them, as retained by one of New Orleans' most exclusive art object shops, and here on the East Coast and in San Francisco. Will they go over, Barney? He studied his precog. Was Miss Fugate right? They'll never go over. That's God's truth. Barney's tone, however, was leaden. The wrong tone, Leo decided, for what he was saying. It was too lacking in vitality. That's what I foresee, Barney said doggedly. Okay, Leo nodded. I'll accept what you're saying. But if her pots become a sensation and we don't have mins of them available for the colonists' layouts, he pondered, you might find your bed partner also occupying your chair, he said. Rising, Barney said, you'll instruct Miss Fugate then as to the position she should take? He colored. I'll rephrase that, he murmured, as Leo began to guffaw. Okay, Barney, I'll lower the fnard on her. She's young, she'll survive. And you're aging. You need to keep your dignity, not have anyone disagree with you. He too rose, walking up to Barney. He slapped him on the back. But listen, stop eating your heart out. Forget that ex-wife of yours, okay? I've forgotten her. There are always more women, Leo said, thinking of Scotty Sinclair, his mistress at the moment. Scotty, right now, frail and blonde but huge in the balcony, hung out at his satellite villa 500 miles at Apogee, waiting for him to knock off work for the week. There's an infinite supply. They're not like early U.S. postage stamps or the truffle skins we use as money. It occurred to him, then, that he could smooth matters by making available to Barney one of his discarded, but still serviceable, former mistresses. I tell you what, he began, but Barney at once cut him off with a savage swipe of his hand. No? Leo asked. No. Anyhow, I'm wound up tight with Ronnie Fugate. One at a time is enough for any normal man. Barney eyed his employer severely. I agree. Lord, I can only see one at a time myself. What do you think, I've got a harem up there at Winnie the Pooh Acres? He bristled. The last time I was up there, Barney said, which was at that birthday party for you back in January. Oh, well, parties, that's something else. You don't count what goes on during parties. He accompanied Barney to the door of the office. You know, Meyerson, I heard a rumor about you, one I didn't like. Someone saw you lugging one of those suitcase-type extensions of a Conap psychiatric computer around with you. Did you get a draft notice? There was silence. Then at last, Barney nodded. And you weren't going to say anything to us, Leo said. We were to find out when, the day you board ship for Mars? I'm going to beat it. Sure you are. Everyone does. That's the way the UN's managed to populate 4 planets, 6 moons. I'm going to fail my mental, Barney said. My precog ability tells me I am. It's helping me. I can't endure enough roids of stress to satisfy them. Look at me. He held up his hands. They perceptibly trembled. Look at my reaction to Miss Fugate's harmless remark. Look at my reaction to Nat bringing in Emily's pox. Look at... Okay, Leo said. But he still was worried. Generally, the draft notices gave only a 90-day period before induction, and Miss Fugate would hardly be ready to assume Barney's chair that soon. Of course, he could transfer Mac Ronston from Paris, but even Ronston, after 15 years, was not of the same caliber as Barney Meyerson. He had the experience, but talent could not be stored up. It had to be there as God-given. The UN is really getting to me, Leo thought. He wondered if Barney's draft notice coming at this particular moment was only a coincidence, or if this was another probe of his weak points. If it is, he decided, it's a bad one. There's no pressure I can put on the UN to exempt him. And simply because I supply those colonists with their candee, he said to himself. I mean, somebody has to. They've got to have it. Otherwise, what good are the perky pat layouts to them? And in addition, it was one of the most profitable trading operations in the Sol system. Many truffle skins were involved. The UN knew that, too. At 12:30 New York time, Leo Bulero had lunch with a new girl who had joined the secretary pool. Pia Jurgens, seated across from him in a secluded chamber of the Purple Fox, ate with precision, her small, neat jaw working in an orderly manner. She was a redhead, and he liked redheads. They were either outrageously ugly or almost supernaturally attractive. Miss Jurgens was the latter. Now, if he could find a pretext by which to transfer her to Winnie the Pooh Acres, assuming that Scotty didn't object, however, and such did not at the present seem very likely. Scotty had a will of her own, which was always dangerous in a woman. Too bad I couldn't wangle Scotty off onto Barney Meyerson, he said to himself. Solve two problems at once. Make Barney more psychologically secure. Free myself for... Nuts, he thought. Barney needs to be insecure. Otherwise, he's as good as on Mars. That's why he's hired that talking suitcase. I don't understand the modern world at all, obviously. I'm living back in the 20th century when psychoanalysts made people less prone to stress. Don't you ever talk, Mr. Bulero? Miss Jurgens asked. No, he thought. Could I dabble successfully in Barney's pattern of behavior? Help him to, what's the word, become less viable? But it was not as easy as it sounded. He instinctively appreciated that, expanded frontal lobe-wise. You can't make healthy people sick just by giving an order. Or can you? Excusing himself, he hunted up the robot waiter and asked that a vidphone be brought to his table. A few moments later, he was in touch with Miss Gleason back at the office. Listen, I want to see Miss Rondinella Fugate from Mr. Meyerson's staff as soon as I get back. And Mr. Meyerson is not to know, understand? Yes, sir, Miss Gleason said, making a note. I heard, Pia Jurgens said when he had hung up. You know, I could tell Mr. Meyerson I see him nearly every day in the... Leo laughed. The idea of Pia Jurgens throwing away the burgeoning future opening for her vis-a-vis himself amused him. Listen, he said, patting her hand. Don't worry. It's not within the spectrum of human nature. Finish your Ganymedean wap-frog croquette and let's get back to the office. What I meant, Miss Jurgens said stiffly, is that it seems a little odd to me that you'd be so open in front of someone else, someone you don't hardly know. She eyed him, and her bosom, already overextended and enticing, became even more so. It expanded with indignation. Obviously the answer is to know you better, Leo said greedily. Have you ever chewed candy? He asked her rhetorically. You should. Despite the fact that it's habit-forming, it's a real experience. He, of course, kept a supply, grade AA, on hand at Winnie the Pooh Acres. When guests assembled, it often was brought out to add color to what otherwise might have passed as dull. The reason I ask is that you look like the sort of woman who has active imagination, and the reaction you get to candy depends, varies with, your imaginative-type creative powers. I'd enjoy trying it sometime, Miss Jurgens said. She glanced about, lowered her voice, and leaned toward him. But it's illegal.
It is?
He stared at her. You know it is. The girl looked nettled. Listen, Leo said. I can get you some. He would, of course, chew it with her. In concert, the user's minds fused, became a new unity. Or at least that was the experience. A few sessions of candy chewing and togetherness, and he would know all there was to know about Pia Jurgens. There was something about her, beyond the obvious physical anatomical enormity, that fascinated him. He yearned to be closer to her. We won't use a layout. By an irony, he, the creator and manufacturer of the Perky Pat micro-world, preferred to use candy in a vacuum. What did a Terran have to gain from a layout, inasmuch as it was a min of the conditions obtaining in the average Terran city? For settlers on a howling, gale-swept moon, huddled at the bottom of a hovel against frozen methane crystals and things, it was something else again. Perky Pat and her layout were an entree back to the world they had been born to. But he, Leo Bolero, he was damn tired of the world he had been born to and still dwelt on. And even Winnie the Pooh Acres, with all its quaint and not-so-quaint diversions, did not fill the void. However, that candy, he said to Miss Jurgens, is great stuff, and no wonder it's banned. It's like religion. Candy is the religion of the colonists, he chuckled. One plug of it, woozled for 15 minutes, and...
He made a sweeping gesture. No more hovel. No more frozen methane.
It provides a reason for living. Isn't that worth the risk and expense? But what is there of equal value for us? He asked himself, and felt melancholy. He had, by manufacturing the Perky Pat layouts and raising and distributing the lichen base for the final packaged product Candy, made life bearable for over 1 million unwilling expatriates from Terra. But what the hell did he get back? My life, he thought, is dedicated to others, and I'm beginning to kick. It's not enough. There was his satellite, where Scotty waited. There existed, as always, the tangled details of his two large business operations, the one legal, the other not. But wasn't there more in life than this? He did not know, nor did anyone else, because, like Barney Meyerson, they were all engaged in their various imitations of him. Barney with his Miss Rondinella Fugate, small-time replica of Leo Bolero and Miss Jurgens. Wherever he looked, it was the same. Probably even Ned Lark, the narcotics bureau chief, lived this sort of life. Probably so did Hepburn Gilbert, who probably kept a pale, tall, Swedish starlet with breasts the size of bowling balls, and equally firm. Even Palmer Eldritch. No, he realized suddenly. Not Palmer Eldritch. He's found something else. For 10 years he's been in the Prox system, or at least coming and going. What did he find? Something worth the effort? Worth the terminal crash on Pluto? You saw the homeopapes? He asked Miss Jurgens. About the ship on Pluto? There's a man in a billion, that Eldritch. No one else like him. I read, Miss Jurgens said, that he was practically a nut. Sure. 10 years out of his life, all that agony, and for what? You can be sure he got a good return for the 10 years, Miss Jurgens said. He's crazy, but smart. He looks out for himself, like everyone else does. He's not that nuts. I'd like to meet him, Leo Bolero said. Talk to him. Even if only just a minute. He resolved then to do that. Go to the hospital where Palmer Eldritch lay, force or buy his way into the man's room, learn what he had found. I used to think, Miss Jurgens said, that when the ships first left our system for another star, remember that?
we'd hear that...
She hesitated.
It's so silly, but I was only a kid then, when Arnoldson made his first trip to Prox and back. I was a kid when he got back, I mean.
I actually thought maybe by going that far he'd...
She ducked her head, not meeting Leo Bolero's gaze.
He'd find God.
Leo thought, I thought so too, and I was an adult then, in my mid-30s. As I've mentioned to Barney on numerous occasions. And, he thought, I still believe that even now, about the 10-year flight of Palmer Eldritch. After lunch, back in his office at PP Layouts, he met Rondinella Fugate for the first time. She was waiting for him when he arrived. Not bad looking, he thought as he shut the office door. Nice figure, and what glorious, luminous eyes. She seemed nervous. She crossed her legs, smoothed her skirt, watched him furtively as he seated himself at his desk facing her. Very young, Leo realized. A child who would speak up and contradict her superior when she thought he was wrong. Touching. Do you know why you're here in my office? He inquired.
I guess you're angry because I contradicted Mr. Meyerson.
But I really experienced the futurity in the lifeline of those ceramics. So what else could I do?
She half rose imploringly, then reseated herself. Leo said, I believe you, but Mr. Meyerson is sensitive. If you're living with him, you know he has a portable psychiatrist that he lugs wherever he goes. Opening his desk drawer, he got out his box of Questa Rays, the very finest. He offered the box to Miss Fugate, who gratefully accepted one of the slender, dark cigars. He, too, took a cigar. He lit hers and then his and leaned back in his chair. You know who Palmer Eldritch is?
Yes.
Can you use your precog powers for something other than pre-fash foresight? In another month or so, the homeopaths will be routinely mentioning Eldritch's location. I'd like you to look ahead to those papes and then tell me where the man is at this moment. I know you can do it.
You had better be able to, he said to himself, if you want to keep your job here.
He waited, smoking his cigar, watching the girl and thinking to himself with a trace of envy that if she was as good in bed as she looked.
Miss Fugate said in a soft, halting voice, I get only the most vague impression, Mr. Bolero.
Well, let's hear it anyhow. He reached for a pen.
It took her several minutes, and as she reiterated, her impression was not distinct. Nonetheless, he presently had on his notepad the words, James Riddle Veterans Hospital, Base 3, Ganymede. A UN establishment, of course, but he had anticipated that. It was not decisive. He still might be able to find a way in.
And he's not there under that name, Miss Fugate said, pale and enervated from the effort of foreseeing.
She relit her cigar, which had gone out. Sitting straighter in her chair, she once more crossed her supple legs.
The homeopaths will say that Eldritch was listed in the hospital records as a Mr.
She paused, squeezed her eyes shut and sighed.
Oh, hell, she said. I can't make it out. One syllable. Trent. Brent. No, I think it's Trent. Yes, it's Eldon Trent.
She smiled in relief. Her large eyes sparkled with naive, childlike pleasure.
They really have gone to a lot of trouble to keep him hidden. And they're interrogating him, the papes will say, so obviously he's conscious.
She frowned then, all at once.
Wait, I'm looking at a headline. I'm in my own Connaught by myself. It's early morning, and I'm reading the front page. Oh, dear.
What's it say? Leo demanded, bending rigidly forward. He could catch the girl's dismay.
Miss Fugate whispered.
The headlines say that Palmer Eldritch is dead.
She blinked, looked around her with amazement, then slowly focused on him. She regarded him with a confused mixture of fear and uncertainty, almost palpably edging back.
She retreated from him, huddled against her chair, her fingers interlocked. "And you're accused of having done it, Mr. Bolero. Honest, that's what the headline says."
"You mean I'm going to murder him?"
She nodded. "But it's not a certainty. I only pick it up in some of the futures, do you understand? I mean, we precogs see..."
She gestured.
"I know."
He was familiar with precogs. Barney Meyerson had, after all, worked for PP Layouts 13 years, and some of the others even longer.
"It could happen," he said gratingly.
"Why would I do a thing like that?"
he asked himself. No way to tell now. Perhaps after he reached Eldritch, talked to him, as evidently he would. Miss Fugate said, "I don't think you ought to try to contact Mr. Eldritch in view of this possible future. Don't you agree, Mr. Bolero? I mean, the risk is there. It hangs very large. About, I'd guess, in the neighborhood of 40.
"What's 40?
"Percent. Almost half the possibilities." Now, more composed, she smoked her cigar and faced him. Her eyes, dark and intense, flickered as she regarded him, undoubtedly speculating with vast curiosity why he would do such a thing. Rising, he walked to the door of the office.
"Thank you, Miss Fugate. I appreciate your assistance in this matter."
He waited, indicating clearly his expectations that she would leave. However, Miss Fugate remained seated. He was encountering the same peculiar streak of firmness that had upset Barney Meyerson.
"Mr. Bolero," she said quietly, "I think I'd really have to go to the UN police about this. We precogs..."
He reshut the office door.
"You precogs," he said, "are too preoccupied with other people's lives."
But she had him. He wondered what she would manage to do with her knowledge.
"Mr. Meyerson may be drafted," Miss Fugate said. "You knew that, of course. Are you going to try to influence them to let him off?"
Candidly, he said, "I had some intentions in the direction of helping him beat it, yes."
"Mr. Bolero," she said in a small, steady voice, "I'll make a deal with you. Let them draft him, and then I'll be your New York prefash consultant."
She waited. Leo Bolero said nothing.
"What do you say?" she asked.
Obviously, she was unaccustomed to such negotiations. However, she intended to make it stick, if possible. After all, he reflected, everyone, even the smartest operator, had to begin somewhere. Perhaps he was seeing the initial phase of what would be a brilliant career. And then he remembered something. Remembered why she had been transferred from the Peking office to come here to New York as Barney Meyerson's assistant. Her predictions had proved erratic. Some of them, too many of them, in fact, had proved erroneous. Perhaps her preview of the headline relating his indictment as the alleged murderer of Palmer Eldritch, assuming that she was being truthful, that she had really experienced it, was only another of her errors. The faulty precognition which had brought her here. Aloud, he said, "Let me think it over. Give me a couple of days."
"Until tomorrow morning," Miss Fugate said firmly.
Leo laughed.
"I see why Barney was so riled up."
And Barney probably sensed with his own precog faculty, at least nebulously, that Miss Fugate was going to make a decisive strike at him, jeopardizing his whole position.
"Listen," he walked over to her. "You're Meyerson's mistress. How'd you like to give that up? I can offer you the use of an entire satellite."
Assuming, of course, that he could pry Scotty out of there.
"No, thank you," Miss Fugate said.
"Why?"
He was amazed. "Your career..."
"I like Mr. Meyerson," she said. "And I don't particularly care for Bub..."
She caught herself.
"Men who've evolved in those clinics."
Again he opened the office door.
"I'll let you know by tomorrow morning."
As he watched her pass through the doorway and out into the receptionist's office, he thought,
That'll give me time to reach Ganymede and Palmer Eldritch. I'll know more then. Know if your foresight seems spurious or not. Shutting the door behind the girl, he turned at once to his desk and clicked the vidphone button connecting him with the outside. To the New York City operator, he said, "Get me the James Riddle Veterans Hospital at Base 3 on Ganymede. I want to speak to a Mr. Eldon Trent, a patient there, person to person." He gave his name and number, then rang off, jiggled the hook, and dialed Kennedy Spaceport. He booked passage for the express ship leaving New York for Ganymede that evening, then paced about his office, waiting for the call back from James Riddle Veterans Hospital. Bubblehead, he thought. She'd call even her employer that. 10 minutes later, the call came. "I'm sorry, Mr. Bolero," the operator apologized. "Mr. Trent is not receiving calls. By doctor's orders." So Rondinella Fugate was right. An Eldon Trent did exist at James Riddle, and in all probability, he was Palmer Eldritch. It was certainly worth making the trip. The odds looked good. Looked good, he thought wryly, that I'll encounter Eldritch, have some kind of altercation with him, God knows what, and eventually bring about his death. A man that at this point in time I don't even know. And I'll find myself arraigned. I won't get away with it. What a prospect. But his curiosity was aroused. In all his manifold operations, he had never found the need of killing anyone under any circumstances. Whatever it was that would occur between him and Palmer Eldritch had to be unique. Definitely a trip to Ganymede was indicated. It would be difficult to turn back now, because he had the acute intuition that this would turn out to be what he hoped. And Rondinella Fugate had only said that he would be accused of the murder. There was no datum as to a successful conviction. Convicting a man of his stature of a capital crime, even through the UN authorities, would take some doing. He was willing to let them try. 3. In a bar hard by PP Layouts, Richard Knatt sat sipping a tequila sour, his display case on the table before him. He knew goddamn well there was nothing wrong with Emily's pots. Her work was saleable. The problem had to do with her ex-husband and his position of power. And Barney Meyerson had exercised that power. "I have to call Emily and tell her," Knatt said to himself. He started to his feet. A man blocked his way, a peculiar round specimen mounted on spindly legs. "Who are you?" Knatt said. The man bobbed toy-like in front of him, meanwhile digging into his pocket as if scratching at a familiar microorganism that possessed parasitic proclivities that had survived the test of time. However, what he produced at last was a business card. "We're interested in your ceramicware, Mr. Hat, Knatt, however you say it." "Eichholz," Knatt said, reading the card. It gave only the name, no further info, not even a VID number. "But what I have with me are just samples. I'll give you the names of retail outlets stocking our line, but these are for minning," the toy-like man, Mr. Eichholz, said, nodding. "And that's what we want. We intend to min your ceramics, Mr. Knatt. We believe that Meyerson is wrong. They will become fashion very soon."
Knatt stared at him.
"You want to min, and you're not from PP Layouts?" But no one else minned. Everyone knew PP Layouts had a monopoly. Seating himself at the table beside the display case, Mr. Eichholz brought out his wallet and began counting out skins. "Very little publicity will be attached to this at first, but eventually..." He offered Knatt the stack of brown, wrinkled truffle skins which served as tender in the Sol system. The only molecule, a unique protein amino acid, which could not be duplicated by the printers, the biltong life forms employed in place of automated assembly lines by many of Terra's industries. "I'll have to check with my wife," Knatt said. Aren't you the representative of your firm?
Yes. He accepted the pile of skins.
The contract.
Eichholz produced a document, spread it flat on the table. He extended a pen.
It gives us an exclusive.
As he bent to sign, Richard Knapp saw the name of Eichholz's firm on the contract. Choosy Manufacturers of Boston. He had never heard of them.
Choosy.
It reminded him of another product, exactly which he could not recall. It was only after he had signed and Eichholz was tearing loose his copy that he remembered. The illegal hallucinogenic drug Can-D, used in the colonies in conjunction with the Perky Pat layouts. He had an intuition compounded by deep unease, but it was too late to back out. Eichholz was gathering up the display case. The contents belonged to Choosy Manufacturers of Boston, USA, Terra, now.
How can I get in touch with you? Nat asked, as Eichholz started away from the table.
You won't be getting in touch with us. If we want you, we'll call you.
Eichholz smiled briefly. How in hell was he going to tell Emily? Nat counted the skins, read the contract, realized by degrees exactly how much Eichholz had paid him. It was enough to provide him and Emily with a 5-day vacation in Antarctica, at one of the great, cool resort cities frequented by the rich of Terra, where no doubt Leo Bulero and others like him spent the summer.
And these days, summer lasted all year round.
Or, he pondered, it could do even more. It could get himself and his wife into the most exclusive establishment on the planet, assuming he and Emily wanted it. They could fly to the Germanies and enter one of Dr. Willy Denkmal's e-therapy clinics.
Wowee, he thought.
He shut himself up in the bar's vidphone booth and called Emily.
Pack your bag, we're going to Munich to...
He picked the name of a clinic at random. He had seen this one advertised in exclusive Paris magazines.
To Eichenwald, he told her. Dr. Denkmal is...
Barney took them, Emily said.
No, but there's someone else in the field of minning now besides PP layouts.
He felt elated.
So Barney turned us down. So what? We did better with this new outfit. They must have plenty. I'll see you in half an hour. I'll arrange for accommodations on TWA's express flight.
Think of it. E-therapy for both of us. In a low voice, Emily said, I'm not sure I want to evolve when it comes right down to it.
Staggered, he said, Sure you do. I mean, it could save our lives, and if not ours, then our kids, our potential kids that we might be having someday.
And even if we're only there a short time and only evolve a little, look at the doors it'll open to us. We'll be personae grati everywhere.
Do you personally know anyone who's had e-therapy? You read about so-and-so in the homeopapes all the time, society people, but...
I don't want that hair all over me, Emily said. And I don't want to have my head expand.
No, I won't go to Eichenwald Clinic.
She sounded completely decided. Her face was placid. He said, Then I'll go alone. It would still be of economic value. After all, it was he who dealt with buyers, and he could stay at the clinic twice as long, evolve twice as much, assuming that the treatments took. Some people did not respond, but that was hardly Dr. Denkmal's fault. The capacity for evolution was not bestowed on everyone alike. About himself, he felt certitude. He'd evolve remarkably, catch up with the big shots, even pass some of them, in terms of the familiar horny rind which Emily, out of mistaken prejudice, had called hair.
What am I supposed to do while you're gone? Just make pots?
Right, he said.
Because orders would be arriving thick and fast. Otherwise, Choosy Manufacturers of Boston would have no interest in the min. Obviously, they employed their own pre-fash precogs as PP layouts did. But then he remembered. Eichholz had said, very little publicity at first. That meant, he realized, that the new firm had no network of disc jockeys circling the colony moons and planets. Unlike PP layouts,
They had no Alan and Charlotte Fane to flash the news to. But it took time to set up disc jockey satellites. This was natural. And yet, it made him uneasy. He thought all at once in panic, could they be an illegal firm? Maybe Choosy, like Candy, is banned. Maybe I've got us into something dangerous. Choosy, he said aloud to Emily. Ever heard of it?
No.
He got the contract out and once more examined it. What a mess, he thought. How'd I get into it? If only that damn Meyerson had said yes on the pots. At 10 in the morning, a terrific horn, familiar to him, hooted Sam Regan out of his sleep, and he cursed the UN ship upstairs. He knew the racket was deliberate. The ship, circling above the hovel chickenpox prospects, wanted to be certain that colonists, and not merely indigenous animals, got the parcels that were to be dropped. We'll get them, Sam Regan muttered to himself as he zipped his insulated overalls, put his feet into high boots, and then grumpily sauntered as slowly as possible toward the ramp.
He's early today, Todd Morris complained, and I'll bet it's all staples, sugar, and food basics like lard. Nothing interesting such as, say, candy. Putting his shoulders against the lid at the top of the ramp, Norm Shine pushed. Bright cold sunlight spilled down on them, and they blinked.
The UN ship sparkled overhead, set against the black sky as if hanging from an uneasy thread. Good pilot, this drop, Todd decided. Knows the Feinberg Crescent area.
He waved at the UN ship, and once more the huge horn burst out its din, making him clap his hands to his ears.
A projectile slid from the underpart of the ship, extended stabilizers, and spiraled toward the ground. Shoot, Sam Regan said with disgust. It is Staples. They don't have the parachute. He turned away, not interested. How miserable the upstairs looked today, he thought as he surveyed the landscape of Mars. Dreary. Why did we come here? Had to. Were forced to. Already the UN projectile had landed. Its hull cracked open, torn by the impact, and the three colonists could see canisters. It looked to be 500 pounds of salt. Sam Regan felt even more despondent. Hey! Shine said, walking toward the projectile and peering. I believe I see something we can use. Looks like radios in those boxes, Todd said. Transistor radios. Thoughtfully, he followed after Shine. Maybe we can use them for something new in our layouts. Mine's already got a radio, Shine said. Well, build an electronic self-directing lawnmower with the parts, Todd said. You don't have that, do you? He knew the Shine's perky pat layout fairly well. The two couples, he and his wife, with Shine and his, had fused together a good deal, being compatible. Sam Regan said, "Dibs on the radios because I can use them." His layout lacked the automatic garage door opener that both Shine and Todd had. He was considerably behind them. Of course, all those items could be purchased, but he was out of skins. He had used his complete supply in the service of a need which he considered more pressing. He had, from a pusher, bought a fairly large quantity of candy. It was buried, hidden out of sight, in the earth under his sleep compartments at the bottom level of their collective hovel. He himself was a believer. He affirmed the miracle of translation, the near-sacred moment in which the miniature artifacts of the layout no longer merely represented Earth, but became Earth. And he and the others, joined together in the fusion of doll inhabitation by means of the Candy, were transported outside of time and local space. Many of the colonists were as yet unbelievers. To them, the layouts were merely symbols of a world which none of them could any longer experience. But, one by one, the unbelievers came around. Even now, so early in the morning, he yearned to go back down below, chew a slice of candy from his hoard, and join with his fellows in the most solemn moment of which they were capable. To Todd and Norm Shine, he said, Either of you care to seek transit?
That was the technical term they used for participation. I'm going back below, he said. We can use my candy. I'll share it with you.
An inducement like that could not be ignored. Both Todd and Norm looked tempted.
So early? Norm Shine said. We just got out of bed.
But I guess there's nothing to do anyhow.
He kicked glumly at a huge semi-autonomic sand dredge. It had remained parked near the entrance of the hovel for days now.
No one had the energy to come up to the surface and resume the clearing operations inaugurated earlier in the month.
It seems wrong, though, he muttered. We ought to be up here working in our gardens.
And that's some garden you've got, Sam Regan said with a grin. What is that stuff you've got growing there? Got a name for it?
Norm Shine, hands in the pockets of his coveralls, walked over the sandy, loose soil with its sparse vegetation to his once carefully maintained vegetable garden. He paused to look up and down the rows, hopeful that more of the specially prepared seeds had sprouted. None had.
Twist chard, Todd said encouragingly, right? Mutated as it is, I can still recognize the leaves.
Breaking off a leaf, Norm chewed it, then spat it out. The leaf was bitter and coated with sand.
Now Helen Morris emerged from the hovel, shivering in the cold Martian sunlight.
We have a question, she said to the three men. I say that psychoanalysts back on Earth were charging $50 an hour, and Fran says it was for only 45 minutes.
She explained, we want to add an analyst to our layout, and we want to get it right because it's an authentic item, made on Earth and shipped here, if you remember that Bolero ship that came by last week.
We remember, Norm Shine said sourly, the prices that the Bolero salesman had wanted. And all the time in their satellite, Alan and Charlotte Fane talked up the different items so, whetting everyone's appetite.
Ask the Fanes, Helen's husband Todd said. Radio them the next time the satellite passes over.
He glanced at his wristwatch. In another hour. They have all the data on authentic items. In fact, that particular datum should have been included with the item itself, right in the carton.
It perturbed him because it had, of course, been his skins, his and Helen's together, that had gone to pay for the tiny figure of the human-type psychoanalyst, including the couch, desk, carpet, and bookcase of incredibly well-minned, impressive books.
You went to the analyst when you were still on Earth, Helen said to Norm Shine. What was the charge?
Well, I mostly went to group therapy, Norm said, at the Berkeley State Mental Hygiene Clinic, and they charged according to your ability to pay. And of course, Perky Pat and her boyfriend go to a private analyst.
He walked down the length of the garden, solemnly deeded to him, between the rows of jagged leaves, all of which were, to some extent, shredded and devoured by microscopic native pests. If he could find one healthy plant, one untouched, it would be enough to restore his spirits. Insecticides from Earth simply had not done the job here. The native pests thrived.
They had been waiting 10,000 years, biding their time, for someone to appear and make an attempt to raise crops.
Todd said, you better do some watering.
Yeah, Norm Shine agreed. He meandered gloomily in the direction of Chickenpox Prospect's hydro-pumping system. It was attached to their now partially sand-filled irrigation network, which served all the gardens of their hovel. Before watering came sand removal, he realized. If they didn't get the big Class A dredge started up soon, they wouldn't be able to water even if they wanted to. But he did not particularly want to. And yet he could not, like Sam Regan, simply turn his back on the scene up there, return below to fiddle with his layout, build or insert new items, make improvements, or, as Sam proposed, actually get out a quantity of the carefully hidden candy and begin the communication. We have responsibilities, he realized. To Helen, he said, ask my wife to come up here. She could direct him as he operated the dredge. Fran had a good eye.
I'll get her, Sam Regan agreed, starting back down below. No one wants to come along? No one followed him. Todd and Helen Morris had gone over to inspect their own garden now, and Norm Schein was busy pulling the protective wrapper from the dredge, preparatory to starting it up. Back below, Sam Regan hunted up Fran Schein. He found her crouched at the perky pat layout which the Morrises and the Shines maintained together, intent on what she was doing. Without looking up, Fran said, "We've got Perky Pat all the way downtown in her new Ford hardtop convert, and parked, and a dime in the meter, and she's shopped, and now she's in the analyst's office reading fortune. But what does she pay?" She glanced up, smoothed back her long dark hair, and smiled at him. Beyond a doubt, Fran was the handsomest and most dramatic person in their collective hovel. He observed this now, and not for anything like the first time. He said, "How can you fuss with that layout and not you?" He glanced around. The two of them appeared to be alone. Bending down, he said softly to her, "Come on, and we'll chew some first-rate candy, like you and I did before, okay?" His heart labored as he waited for her to answer. Recollections of the last time the two of them had been translated in unison made him feel weak. "Helen Morris will be..." "No, they're cranking up the dredge above. They won't be back down for an hour." He took hold of Fran by the hand, led her to her feet. "What arrives in a plain brown wrapper," he said as he steered her from the compartment out into the corridor, "should be used, not just buried. It gets old and stale, loses its potency." "And we pay a lot for that potency," he thought morbidly. "Too much to let it go to waste." Although some, not in this hovel, claimed that the power to ensure translation did not come from the candee, but from the accuracy of the layout. To him, this was a nonsensical view, and yet it had its adherents. As they hurriedly entered Sam Regan's compartment, Fran said, "I'll chew in unison with you, Sam, but let's not do anything while we're there on Terra that, you know, we wouldn't do here. I mean, just because we're Pat and Walt and not ourselves, that doesn't give us license." She gave him a warning frown, reproving him for his former conduct and for leading her to that yet unasked. End of side one. To continue, turn the cassette over.